Hey folks, it's your friend and your first Bad Ideas co-host, Gabriel Urbina, here with a very quick announcement. Zach, Sarah, and I have been hard at work on a couple of new things, a couple of new ideas, and new projects that, fingers crossed, we'll hopefully be able to talk to you about and be able to tell you more about in the very near future. And it's very exciting and very awesome, but also very time consuming. In fact, it's so time consuming that this week we were just not quite able to finish putting together a whole new No Bad Ideas episode for you. But never fear, we've pulled out one of our favorite episodes from the No Bad Ideas Vault, one of the early, early episodes in our feed that you can no longer listen to on a regular No Bad Ideas feed, and we're going to present it for you as a special Bad Ideas Classic Edition. And then we'll be back on your feeds with a whole brand new episode next week. And hopefully, before too long, we'll also have some exciting announcements about new things coming down the pipeline. But until then, I leave you in the very capable hands of past Gabrielle, past Sarah, and past Zach. Enjoy.
This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
I'm your first bad idea reckoning with hopefully good storytelling host, Gabriel Urbina.
I am going to go with just host number two, no promises, Sarah Shackett.
And I am the knight.
No, I'm just excellent.
I'm like, how did we book the night? Like, yeah,
that's a coup for us.
Yeah, right? Like, oh man. Oh, wait.
Who's going just, to for a Batman vibe?
Just yeah. Zach.
Batman. No, it's Zach Man.
No, sorry.
Oh no. I can hear the memes from here.
We are in the Zach cave.
And as disappointing as it is to not have the night with us, we are very happy to have you, Zach. And we're also very happy to be joined by a special guest today.
Hello.
So wonderful to have you here, Lindsay Amer of Queer Kids Stuff.
Thanks
and
for having me.
Other amazing things around the internet.
Yeah, I do things on the internet. They're fun.
I've loved seeing your creations blossom, and you have some big news today.
Yeah, my T-minus half an hour ago, my TED Talk just went live on the internet.
That's so
many bananas.
Dope. Well, this will be published a little bit later, so folks, go check that out. But in the meantime, for anybody new here, No Bad Ideas is a writing exercise that we've invented to keep ourselves fresh as we live in the minds of development hell.
Because as some people have pointed it out, if there's something that we're really good at, is taking things that we do and then going, how can we gamify this? How can we turn this into a recursive loop of, you know, high stakes successes or failures? And that's how we've made this show.
So today, Sarah,
I do
has a terrible idea.
I had several bad ideas that I could choose from, but I just decided to follow my heart and pick something that I love. So I hope y'all all like witches.
Oh yes, I'm a gay person.
Amazing.
The witch love is strong with these ones.
Excellent. So this comes from a site called Live Science. And I believe that it was originally carried by I've lost the British newspaper that it came from. But in any case, Live Science, and the headline of this article is "For Sale: Haunted Medieval Prison That Held Accused Witches."
Oh boy.
Very good. And your listeners, if your ears just perked up like, ooh, I could use one of those.
Right.
You'll be able to find the article link in the description.
A small building in England that was once a medieval prison for people accused of witchcraft is now a cozy home in need of a new owner.
Oh, it's a home.
But prospective buyers should be forewarned. The sordid history of the former jail, known as The Cage,
has
led many to believe that the house is haunted, with some calling it the most haunted house in England. British real estate agency, Home Domus.
There's a real estate agency behind this?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Like, it's something when the real estate agency is like, you know what?
Let's just lean into this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most haunted house.
It's like a diminishing returns of sellability.
Right.
For hauntings.
Right.
That's where people just need to like swing boldly and hope for the best.
With quote, this is from the agency. With a reputation attracting TV crews from around the world, this unique two bedroom cottage comes available with many resident ghosts.
It's only two bedrooms?
No. Located in St. Osyth in Essex, the building was recently placed on the market by owner Vanessa Mitchell. This is the third time that Mitchell has tried to sell the cage since moving out in 2008, according to local news.
Who would ever want to move out of this plum house?
Wait, how did she acquire it in the first place,
That's a
though?
Good question.
Maybe it was probably. Like,
that's what
she's
I was
a witness.
Sort of like an It Followed situation, maybe.
Mm.
Mitchell reportedly fled the house in 2000 and moved elsewhere after seeing, quote, mysterious blood spatters and being,
holy
quote,
shit,
physically attacked by malevolent ghosts. One of which, this is why I picked this idea, y'all, one of which was, quote, a satanic looking goat, Mitchell told
goat.
The Gazette.
Wow.
Goat.
Jesus.
Goat. During the St. Osyth witch trials in 1582, 14 women were accused of witchcraft-related crimes, for which three were executed, the East Anglian Times reported.
Were all 14 women kept in this only two-bedroom
house? In the cage?
Yeah,
well,
probably.
I imagine the two bedrooms were for the non-witch overlords.
Jailers, yeah.
And okay. That it's probably like a 100-room house, but... You can't consider cages in the basement.
Right.
Like the dungeon the, is not
right,
a bedroom.
The Harry Potter cupboards
right,
don't
that doesn't,
count.
Right, yeah, right. That doesn't count towards your two bed, one bath situation.
I was at first imagining like a large industrial like warehouse size place, right. And now I'm thinking about like a two bedroom cottage.
Yeah, right.
So like what's the in between
well,
there?
I'm imagining the like, what is it? The Dexter's Lab underneath.
Right, right,
yes,
right.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the only listing that is two bedrooms, five sub basements.
Right. Exactly.
Just to finish this out, I think we're already on a good track here. Essex was a hotbed of witchcraft trials during the 16th and 17th centuries. Of the 112 witches who were accused in England in the 1640s alone, 82 were put to death in Essex, the Times reported. In 1921, two female skeletons that were thought to be the remains of executed witches were unearthed in a St. Osyth garden during a construction project. Some of the bones appeared to have been pierced with nails, a common practice for dead witches to keep the spirits from haunting the living, according to the Times. The asking price for the alleged haunted former prison is... £240,000.
That's how much they'll pay you if you take it off their hands?
Or $305,000.
Take off the thousand and I'll get it.
According to online. So yes, that is how much you can pay right now if you want to live in a haunted former jail that may or may not have a satanic goat.
The most haunted.
You know what? There's first that asking price, but then there's also the price under it that you have to calculate of how much sage you need to burn.
That's
right,
true.
Right, right, right.
Homes are, you know, there's always something with a home. You're always doing upkeep. There's always more sage. Right, I'm going to put 10 minutes on our pause. I'm going to put 10 or 15 minutes.
15.
All right. I'm going to put 15 minutes on this here timer, and then I will leave you... to brew your witch's potion.
So the first thing that comes to my mind
hearing upon this for a possible story that could use some of this nonsense.
The worst Airbnb ever.
Did not just have it be like another haunting on Hill House type setting. Yeah, right. Hapless family moves in. What a great house. What could possibly go wrong? Turns out it's haunted. To not just do that. Have it be something like some Stephen King-like character that is a novelist of horror novels.
Oh, sure.
Has writing block. And he's kind of like, I need a new place to inspire me. And then this comes on and it's like, perfect. I'm already behind schedule. My editor's breathing down my neck. I need to get roll spooked real fast.
A very specific like creative retreat just for horror writers.
But the problem is that he's written so many horror books that he gets there and he's kind of jaded and it's kind of like,
oh, it's sort of like a Cabin in the Woods kind
demon,
of a thing.
We've seen it all. And now it's the ghosts having to step up their game, kind of having to be like, man, like we've just been like in a creative rut for 300 years. How are we going
and
to be able to scare?
And they help each other out of their creative rut. I love this so much.
Oh, that's great.
But other than this sort of like that basic setup, I have no idea to kind of like how it escalates or where it goes from there.
I'm seeing like a Scooby-Doo type scenario. Uh-huh. Something like that, where like you have this like guy who's like super jaded and like lives in like this is creepy guy and lives in this like super haunted witch house, and then you have like this like young gang of like teens who are like trying to solve a murder mystery and with their like cute little dog and they're the ones who have to like figure out and navigate that like horror side of things when you have this person who's been like so normalized to it.
I can see that working.
I love that. So basically we have the guy's moved in. He's like still behind on his deadlines and just like waiting for the ghost to step it up, and meanwhile like the local teen sort of ghost club?
Yeah, like they're like those YouTubers who like go into like abandoned buildings and are like,
look
at this like cool thing, and they have millions of subscribers of like people who are like, oh, I don't want to go into abandoned buildings, but I want to watch you going to
I forgot about like Scooby-Doo in the age of YouTube. Oh my lord.
Right?
That's crazy. I didn't think about that.
And they probably sort of think of whoever bought the house as kind of like an older, fuddy-duddier, kind of like, you know, like his stuff hasn't been scary since the 90s, you know.
Washed up horror writer who lives in a haunted witch house.
Right.
Okay.
Man, this is way better. My brain went to like a comedy of realtors who are trying to sell haunted property.
Ooh.
And just like they're the people you call to try and by any means necessary get rid of your haunted house. But I really like the combining of the two ideas of you know, the kids who are trying to do like sort of stunts or murder mystery solving, and the sort of jaded, slightly panicked writer's block writer who is in the house for a very different reason, and like maybe the scariest thing that they encounter is each other in some way or something.
Right. I feel that that is the choice that we kind of are hurtling towards of we need to make a call of, is the place actually haunted? Like, are there actually ghosts in residence?
I think you can make that choice, but I think you can also make it comedic through farce.
Okay, sure.
Doing like a farce with ghosts, I think that would be fun, because you have so many like dungeony chambers. You could like do a comedy of errors kind of thing of like, ooh, what if there are like twin ghost witches, and everyone like kind of going in and out of the cells. And I mean, Scooby-Doo is so much like that. I think you could have like a fun comedic thing with that, and then also with like a team of realtors like running around trying to find the ghosts and catch the ghosts and like trying to figure out.
Just like, go away, ghosts. Just go away for this viewing. You can come back in 15 minutes.
Exactly.
I like the idea that the sort of fuddy-duddy sort of washed up writer ends up taking at first he's annoyed by the teens breaking into his house because, you know, property breaking and entering. But
or as they say, get off my lawn.
Right. But slowly he realizes that this is the perfect premise. And he's just like milking it for his new novel. He ends up upping the stake. Like the ghosts are just like on vacation. He's just torturing his kids to get a better story. I like the idea
that
it's actually haunted. I agree with you that my mind, Sarah, went exactly to like the person. So the lady who owned the house like runs out one night and calls up her realtor, and it's just like the three times that they've tried to sell the house, and like the first time they're just, they try to lie about it and it comes up and they pass.
Right.
The second time they're like trying to admit that it's haunted and they just don't get anything. So then the third time they're like, no, we got to go
lean in.
We just like got out of the deal and we're just going to fucking go for this. Like it's the most haunted house. Like it just like really lean in and
right. For a long time, they were trying to do, there are certain apartments.
They were doing damage control. Yeah.
Realtors try to show certain apartments and like the 15-minute stretches between like when the train goes by and you realize that it's like right next to the tracks.
Yeah.
These guys at first were trying to do it in like the 10-minute intervals between like when the blood came out of the walls. Right. And then eventually they had to kind of be like, no. Like that's a perk. Like it's exclusive. Like you are not going to get like better wall blood anywhere else
in
England.
You see that spatter pattern? That's basically a Pollock.
Yeah.
Right. Those bastards in Saxony are lying about their most haunted house. That's just bullshit.
Now I'm imagining like a HGTV like Fixer Upper episode.
Oh, my God.
Haunted houses.
Yeah,
that would be a funny series. Just imagining like, you know, lace goes really well with blood.
And like halfway through the episode you have a seance.
Oh my gosh. But we were sort of crystallizing the idea of the old man and the teens in the ghost house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's probably kind of being very annoyed at them, and then one day he's kind of all of a sudden like, for whatever reason, checks out their YouTube channel, and all of a sudden it's like 5 million views. How are these idiots getting 5 million views? And it's like all these videos of them kind of, you know, going into like a somewhat spooky barn, and people just love it. And he's kind of like, what? I haven't got engagement like that in years. What's going on here?
So does he invent like the haunted house, or he's just living in a haunted house and the teens don't know about it yet? Does he have to like lure them there?
Good questions. So I'm guessing that the house itself looks pretty damn haunted.
Cool.
Because if the realtors were kind of hyping it up as, you know, the most haunted house in England, I bet that they at least made it up to look pretty spooktastic.
And there's probably not much you have to do if it's always raining over the house.
Yeah.
And I'm down if we're especially going in a comedy direction to just go super over the top. And just like, there's always like lightning and like, there's just a horde of black cats that like live on the ground.
Nothing can grow.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. When the wind blows, there's like something that sounds suspiciously like a creepy organ, which is not something that the wind should be able to do at all. Right, but still. Okay, so he moves into this house. One day he's like, why? What is all this racket? I'm trying to come up with like a new novel idea. He looks up and it's this like gang of teenagers kind of, you know, like creeping up to his house.
With their selfie sticks.
Right.
Their selfie sticks, very important.
And he's kind of like, hey, kids, this lawn, which is mine, you should be getting off of. But they keep sort of like pestering him. And eventually he kind of gets to the point of, you know what? Like, I'm going to start fucking with them. I'm going to start like as revenge. I'm going to like put on as scary a house as I possibly can. And this is where like it could go either way, of kind of like either he just bought a spooky house and now he's going to kind of plant the story that it is the most haunted house in England to fuck with the kids. Or he really had this knowledge and is now just kind of unleashing the house on the kids.
I think the unleashing.
Unleashing is the way
to
go.
I think that they need to be so fish out of water that they have no fucking clue what's going on.
Because this is the first house that they've been in that's actually haunted.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
The only thing they've encountered so far is like slightly creaking wood.
Yeah,
which made them freak and pee their pants. Yeah.
Sure. We're talking about him using the kids to boost his audience. Is that still part of the idea?
Possibly.
Could be, yes, but...
You have 5 minutes, 20 seconds, by the way.
Oh, Lord, lovely.
Sorry.
I didn't need to apologize for that. It could be, but say more. Yes, like, I do not know what to do past what we have so far.
Right, I sort of like the idea of him trying to use the kids for content. And they're trying to use him for content.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I guess my question is, does it start out sort of antagonistic and then become more of a, you know, sort of a collaborative thing?
Well, can we bring the realtors back in at that point and talk about how, he's trying to get the house sold, right? Still, is that part of it?
It can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think maybe the realtors, because if they start being in kind of cahoots with each other, then we need something else to have a conflict with, right? So bringing in the realtors and them having this like high stakes thing of like needing to get the house sold.
Oh, how about this? He's so washed up that he's under bankruptcy.
Oh.
And the repo people are trying to take the house and set, it's like, you know, it's up for auction.
There we go. Yeah.
And he's got to pull out like a novel out of nowhere, or you know where, so that he can keep his creepy house and live his creepy life. And so maybe it starts out sort of antagonistic, like it's a little bit like Sandlot-y, where like, you know, they think he's this creepy, scary old man, but really he's kind of desperate and lonely. And at first he's grouchy because he's like stressed about, you know, paying for this house. But then it slowly dawns on him that these kids are exactly what he's needed to reinvigorate his career by unleashing ghosts on them to get new ideas for like his creepy, crazy novels, and then also getting the distribution of all their fans.
I like it.
And, yeah, they can help him set up a Patreon.
Oh, there you go. I like this generational story. And the true evil in this story is capitalism. Yeah, capitalism.
The true villain of every story.
Oh boy. So I feel like we have a rough structure for the three acts, which is like, you know, act one, the sort of, what's the word?
His story, right?
His desperation and isolation is interrupted.
He's basically living in like the Addams Family house, but by now he's so jaded and so over it.
And the ghosts are probably like really jaded and over it too. Totally. Like there's
it's a stale marriage.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah. Morning, Archibald.
Yeah. What'd you do this weekend?
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
Just
cool.
Hung out in the walls. Yeah. Cool. Me too.
Rankled your chains around. Cool story.
And then the sort of equilibrium is shaken up by these traveling kid ghost hunters who are looking for real ghosts. By God, and they get way more than they bargained for breaking into his house.
2 minutes, by the way.
At first, it is sort of a tense fight, but then slowly they realize that they're exactly what they've been looking for in each other. And and he basically keeps giving them more, you know, he's like, no, go to this room, you know, right. And just sort of giving them better and better content, which gives him better and better ideas for his novels. But meanwhile, the sort of the bank is coming to reclaim his house.
Some real estate developer is buying up all the land in the area so that they can put together a mega super quadruplex mall or whatever.
Haunted Disneyland.
That it's just Disneyland, but it's haunted.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, like, but like some like really schlocky sort of like caricature version of a haunted house kind of thing.
Right.
That has none of the original artistry.
Right. No, it's like one of those like, you know, like biggest yarn situations on the side of the highway. Oh, they're just going to monetize it.
Or just like take this like large industrial thing that has like a tiny cottage attached to it and just turn that whole thing into a mall.
Yeah.
Haunted mall.
Haunted mall.
I mean, not trying to be haunted, just like wiping away the history of it.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I thought they would lean into it cartoonally.
No, like, probably not. They would just be like cement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kicking the ghosts out.
So how do they defeat the corporation?
Well, I mean, I think that there's probably kind of a like, it's probably kind of a fundraiser type story of sort of, you need to come up with $1.5 million by X day in order to pay back the loan that he has with the bank, or otherwise they're selling the deed to his house to the evil corporation or whatever. And so they keep sort of making more and more videos and sort of, you know, putting out more new stories and kind of raising the money. I don't know what the big climax is. Like, I don't know what it's building up.
That's time.
So. As I was saying, they just keep doing that until they fix the problem. Done.
That's most of the way through a story, though, guys. I'm impressed.
That was pretty fun.
Solid pitch.
We didn't even get to my favorite part of the article, which is the former owner that fled.
Fled.
That's so good.
Ran away from the house.
Oh, man.
Good Lord.
But, like, weirdly held on to it for 4 years before trying to sell it.
Weirdly bought it in the first place.
Also yeah, that. Actually,
all
though.
Of these are the most British thing I've ever heard, though.
Why do I have the feeling that they bought it without knowing what they were getting themselves into?
Yeah.
I like that we came out of that with a comedy.
Yeah.
No, that was great. Yeah. Intergenerational, like YouTube, like feel millennial. Good.
Right.
Like feel good film.
If there is a truth universally acknowledged and no bad ideas, is that like whenever the bad idea involves like something really scary or something really awful or something really heavy, we'll kind of be like, what if there's a bunch of pratfalls in it and it's really funny? And conversely, when it's like, man tries to rob bank with a banana, we kind of go into like, what if it's like a really slow burn of a psychological exploration of what makes a man
yes.
like feel so desperate and alone that he robs a bank with a banana.
I like it.
Waiting for banana.
Oh no.
All right, we're going to go to commercial before we have any more of that. So we'll be right back.
Another bad idea for you, this time from me. Oh, one second. I like what you do when we come back and you're like, welcome back. This is No Bad Ideas and we're this, right. that, and the other. Welcome back, everybody. This is another No Bad Ideas story game. I'm Zach Valenti.
I'm Gabriel Urbina.
I'm Sarah Shackett.
And I'm Lindsay.
Yeah. And so today I have something awful. From once again, the pit, none other than r/today I learned on Reddit.
Truly the bottomless pit.
Oh, it's really amazing. It's really made my life a lot easier for this show. and this is maybe the worst idea I've found so far.
Ooh. Ooh.
Okay, all right.
Them's fighting words.
Today I learned about, quote, liondromes, an extension of 1930s Daredevil motordromes. Racing cars on near vertical circular wooden tracks.
Okay.
But with lions inside cars.
Wait.
Lions inside cars?
Like someone is driving the car. Yes. Inside the car, there's also
there's
at least one lion.
With a lion.
That poor lion.
And then they're driving vertically.
Lion.
Wait.
Oh
what are you like God, driving what? Vertically like?
Hold on. So one major driver of the liondrome circuit, Marjorie Kemp, was mauled
by
her feline companions at four times throughout her career. So it clicks through to a Gizmodo article in 1930s. Daredevils would drive up walls with lions for passengers.
One moment.
Oh, in the passenger seat.
This is a terrible idea.
You're welcome.
This is really awful. I must say, I personally applaud anyone that was so sure that this was their calling and this was the thing that they wanted to do in life, that they would keep doing it after they got mauled, not once,
not twice,
but three times.
I think it was four.
Well, but I don't have a confirmation that they kept doing it after the fourth time.
That's true. Right. Well,
so
insightful.
Hats off, Marjorie.
So, filed to holy crap WTF on gizmodo.com. last week, we met a lion tamer who used his power of persuasion to transform his cats into a stately throne. Today, we will examine... That's another article.
Yeah.
Today, we will examine the defunct
practice. That's a sneak peek into a future Bad Ideas, Bad Ideas episode.
today, we will examine the defunct practice of corralling large, semi-unpredictable cats into motordromes, training them to sit in sidecars and tearing ass up perilous inclines with these apex predators in tow.
You can accurately predict that they will maul you.
To convince a lion to act docile as Burt Ward, a carnival workers couldn't simply travel to the Serengeti and issue comically oversized paw-shaped driver's licenses. No, in August 1930, Popular
Hats
Mechanics detailed a rider who was training a cub for a lifetime of, quote, I did not sign up for this, stunt racing.
the poor cub.
There's a photo with a caption, and it is wild. They are like basically on a wall in a car, and that is a lion. The driver takes an added passenger, a five-month-old jungle cub, which crouches in a frame built on the side of the car. The most difficult part of the remarkable stunt is to induce the lion to remain quiet throughout the wild ride.
No!
As a move
that's the hardest
on
part?
The part of the animal might be disastrous to both occupants of the car. Of course, commanding a carnivorous cat to stay put on an automobile while whizzing about near vertical for a motley throng of rye-addled looky-loos never was an easy task.
There's an audience for this?
Yes! It's
There's
a sport!
A live audience?
In 1938, a lion who belonged to Joseph Dobish, the owner of Wildwood, New Jersey's Motordrome Wall of Death, famously escaped and killed an unlucky passerby. Christ, it's dangerous to watch.
Yeah.
This particular lion didn't have the temperament for the wall of death. But
I take so much issue with any blame play being placed on the lion at all.
For Gabrielle, we're about to get to Marjorie Kemp.
No, it's just gonna
the wall of death.
Oh, the phrasing of this thing didn't have the temperament for the wall of death.
Wall of death material. But the stalwart rider, Marjorie Kemp, on the stalwart rider on the Liondrome circuit, was mauled by her feline companions at least four times throughout her career. And if having...
She had a career in this?
Oh my God, she was a professional. And if having a somewhat confused man-eater riding shotgun wasn't dangerous enough for these death defiers, they could always participate in a variation of the Wall of Death known as the Race for Life.
No.
In 2006, profile of Motordromes, the New York Times detailed this spectacle along with the warning days the waning days of the Liondromes. Quote, once the riders were zooming around the walls, trained lions would be released and would charge after the motorcycles, swatting with their huge paws. They usually wouldn't catch the bikes. Sonny Pelicans,
nothing
I'm probably
good ever
butchering
comes
his
out
name,
of New Jersey.
Family owned and operated the last of the Liondromes. That era came to an ignominious end after a drunken carnival worker stuck his hand into a lion cage in 1964 and was bitten by a male lion named King. The police were called, and one bullet later, King was gone, and the last Liondrome closed. Let's see. This is towards the end. That is sad. The link for this article, by the way, will be in the description for anybody who wants to see the tremendous photos. For those of you who wish to watch some Liondrome in motion, you can find a clip of one such centrifugal field over at British Pathé. It's a thrill, quote, it's a thrill for everybody, spectators, lion, and our cameraman too. In a reality less preoccupied with the general welfare of human and beast alike, Liondromes and bear wrestling bouts are held every other Tuesday.
I'm just imagining an ESPN channel that is like all animal themed sporting.
Whew. That's the end of that article.
Yikes.
So basically,
my God, these photos are ridiculous.
Yeah, I have questions about what this looks like.
Yo, if this is our girl Marjorie Kemp, that is not a sidecar. That is just a lion in the car with her.
No, they said passenger seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, the Roman Colosseum was like, we are the most appalling, most dangerous form of entertainment involving lions.
And the 1930s were like, hold my beer.
The Romans were like, 15 naval
minutes on
battles,
the clock, everybody.
And then Ernest Hemingway was like,
oh my God, wow. As a great musical once taught me, truly everything is legal in New Jersey, apparently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, do the lions have seatbelts? This is a question
it
that I have.
Sure. Is hard to see from the pictures. I would imagine
no. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Lord. See, so I'm very conflicted here because really my first instinct is just film it and like that would be like the thriller of the year. Like Jesus Christ, get like Hugh Jackman in here and like call it a day.
Right.
But I don't want to do anything that in any way glamorizes or like makes this anything about this practice that sounds truly appalling and truly abusive to these poor animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, this in is any my, way kind of like
bad idea.
My, yeah, well, my no. only thought is to make them all lions, drivers and passengers alike.
Right, it's kind of like a Pixar or a Zootopia style kind of like...
Like racing film.
Mm-hmm.
Because my film. God, this is wild. And I really don't want to make it look fun or interesting.
You could flip it and have the lions with their human snack. Like some weird intelligent lion animated series where they're just like the lesser...
Sure, right.
This one's tough because the tone, it's about the tone here.
Yeah.
Right? You could do something that's like glamorizes it, but in like a really ironic way. And flips it on its head in that way. So you're still telling something that's like really like earnest feeling, but it's like there's a fucking lion here.
Yeah. I just don't want to green book this lion situation.
No. Ooh, yeah.
You know, like, I feel there's an old Cary Grant movie called Only Angels Have Wings that is about kind of like the truly like stupid death-defying things that used to happen for timely mail delivery in South America when like kind of like the U.S. was first kind of having like business interests down there. And part of, I think, what makes it work is that just like periodically throughout the movie, people just die. Like, it's not kind of like one big death to kind of establish, this is dangerous. It's like, oh, no, like periodically just like accidents happen. And every time that you're kind of getting comfortable and having a moment of kind of like, but I kind of like these like asshole daredevil pilots. It's like, oh, no, hang on a second. They just got like someone killed for a very stupid reason. And I feel that it would need to kind of be something like that, where like throughout the movie, there kept being accidents and there kept being these things. These moments. Of kind of like, and I think like the one that like is truly frightening to me is the one where it's like the spectator that got hurt.
Yeah.
Right.
That's sort of the one where I'm kind of like, wow. Like if I saw that in a movie, that would sort of be kind of be like, oh, wow. Like I'm now like that kind of breaks through the parameters.
I wonder if focusing on the woman Marjorie would help as a way in.
I Tonya.
Yeah, well, like I Tonya, but like, but also like, if her and her like best lion friend are like these like beautiful companions,
right?
And then they're forced into this like weird situation.
This is the only way that she can maintain custody of the lion, right? Or you know something. Along the lines of, like, you know, they're doing this and the hopefully incredible amount of money they're being paid to do is going towards, like, a good cause or something like that.
Oh, so I have a really bad idea that I'm kind of like, oh, that might actually, like, tug at my heartstrings a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the thing that I just remembered is that there was that mention of someone rearing up a lion from when he was a cub.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, sort
right,
of like
right.
like from birth, kind of grooming this animal.
The avatar of Liondrome.
Right. So your protagonist is someone that is like the daughter of a circus family. And sort of specifically the daughter of people that kind of work in big act cats. Big cat acts, rather.
Yeah.
Just flip those around.
Those are all the words.
order is not important. And at a certain point, one of the lionesses has a litter. They have like a set of cubs.
They
get one of the lions to take care of them. But at a certain point, it kind of becomes clear that this is the runt of the litter and they're not going to be able to do sort of like the big stunts that is expected of the circus big cat acts.
But they can fit in a car.
That's right. No, and at a certain point, their dad kind of goes up to the protagonist and is kind of like, look, we can't afford to be keeping on this line if it's not going to be pulling its own weight. And she's kind of going,
I'm going to find a way. Yeah.
Right. And then I don't know if she creates it or if somebody's like, you know where like you this lion could really shine.
I would in that case like maybe keep it within a circus and sort of elide the fact that this was a sport.
Sure.
You know, and just stay with the protagonist and their relationship with this cub. And you know, maybe this is a young girl who like the only time she sort of feels free from all of the constraints of the circus is like driving in a car
kind on of the wall of death,
and like is able and is but is like sort of a stunt driver, you know, like that's her thing. And so is able to incorporate like this thing that her family loves and this thing that she loves and this adorable cub that she loves and is going to be less freaked out by in the film than those lions probably were in real life.
So it turns into like a buddy show about like a girl and her like lion cub who just like drive around the country.
Right, about like the two underdogs.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think that inevitably there would need to be sort of something where it's like they need to like win, like, you know, Lion Drome, or, you know, they need to kind of go up against.
Or, there's people. Like a, you know, sort of in the way that magicians would challenge each other and stuff, like another circus, like the act is really successful and another circus comes up with something even more ridiculous. And then they have to like race each other to figure out who is like the king of the big top or whatever.
Without
getting mauled. Yeah.
Jesus.
Or somebody buys the circus and now they want her to do the act with a tiger.
Right.
Or something like that. You know, where it's kind of like, we need to get bigger and better.
Right.
An elephant in the car.
Oh, man.
Better have a good car.
An alligator in the car.
Oh, no. Yikes.
Yeah.
I think we found it.
We could make the sort of the moral past we wish we had, where like somebody buys the circus and tries to make it only Lion Drome, like tries to basically start the sport and they have to, like, it's like sort of the walk away moment where they're just like, they draw the line, like, like, no.
Her and the lion cub like walk off into the sunset, like, fuck you.
Yeah. Right. I wonder how far they would get wrapped up in it and just balancing, like, keeping it entertaining for the butts in the seats without like making it, without glorifying animal abuse.
I think she would have to get mauled.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Mauled by her friend.
Yeah.
And she understands that it's not the friend's fault.
Yeah.
Oh, that's dark.
Yeah. And I think that it needs to be, you know, I think that anything that is kind of like related to the historical past of kind of animal acts in the circus needs to really sort of reckon with the twin forces of like, these were people that were most of the time on the edge of being broke. And a lot of the times kind of the circus going was the only thing that was letting certain families stay together, letting sort of certain kinds of people that really did not fit in anywhere else have jobs, while at the same time continuing practices that were really terrible, both to like their employees and the animals in them.
Yeah, that but like that, it is, that's why it is a wonderful cauldron for sort of, I think, those friendship movies, because you have a bunch of lost souls who can find each other.
Yeah. And so I think that it needs to kind of be an act that is just successful enough.
Right.
Like, it can never sort of be like,
like wildly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I assume that it's going to be set somewhere in like the 20s or 30s kind of.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Definitely. Yeah.
Just wanted to check. Just wanted to check.
Early Barnum and what's Barnum?
Yeah,
Barnum
P.T.
and Bailey.
Barnum. Yeah.
Yeah.
5.5 minutes.
I guess we can sort of figure out how it resolves.
Yeah.
I guess the first question in my mind is whether our protagonist, I'm just going to call her Marjorie because it's easier, and her lion cub companion are able to stay together at the end of the movie or need to go separate ways.
It could go either way.
Yeah.
My inclination is that they stay together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of one of those, what is sort of like the ultimate challenge that they need to kind of overcome? Or do they need to kind of win at the big Lion Drome face-off of 1928? Do they need to kind of, is it sort of something where
they need to raise an amount of money because the villain is capitalism?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Always.
Is it something where some of the lions escape from the circus?
Sure.
And they need to kind of, you know, track them down before they're put down by sort of like the local hunters or whatever.
Yeah, the police or whatever.
If you wanted a feel-good ending, you could have her like set the lion free like in Africa. And then at the very end, there's that like video of that guy getting like reunited with his lion. Yeah, and do something like that. Who knows if they're going to recognize each other and like you're going to get attacked. But then it's really like a nice little like lion hug. Nice big lion hug.
Sort of like a coda ending where it's like there's been some time apart.
Yeah.
And maybe both of them have come on hard times and nothing like an old friend.
Yeah.
It could also be something where it's not necessarily like the big Lion Drome tournament.
Right.
But something where it's they're having like a big like maverick talent show somewhere. And the prize is $5 million
or whatever. Yeah.
And so then it's kind of one of those, like, the top kids in their little pond have to now go and sort of, you know, realize what it's up to go up against. Kind of like the big daredevil acts from all over the world. And you have kind of the guy that is the first person that is juggling chainsaws on fire. And the first person that is, you know, sort of like all these crazy fucking evil Knievel type things.
Over the alligator pit and like,
the
motorcycle jump over the lion pit. I
don't
So it's Pitch Perfect, but for stunt acts.
Exactly.
Great.
But still starring Anna Kendrick.
In 3D.
Anna Kendrick would actually be pretty good.
And there's sort of someone that is kind of going like, nah, the wall of death with the lion in your car, that was pretty good for like the backwoods of the States. But now that you're here in Pamplona, that's now you need to do like whatever was the second the variant where it was like they were actually being chased or something
they're being on a motorcycle.
The race of life.
The race of life.
They release lions in the motor motor dome or whatever.
Oh man. And like Anna Kendrick's lion can be sabotaging the other lions to like protect her friend.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my god.
It's like R2-D2, but a lion.
That setup of it almost feels more ethical, almost.
Like almost, yeah.
Like, because at least the lion isn't like confined to the passenger seat of a car and like can get can like run around. I mean, like definitely
can,
less
like, free range eat. I don't know.
Yeah, but they may do sort of those things that is like before the race of life, they don't feed them for like 5 days or something. Yeah,
that's true.
I'm guessing that the ones in the passenger seat may at least get taken care of pretty well to keep them docile.
That's true.
Right.
Really, there's no winner here.
No,
like this entire thing just sounds so barbaric and awful.
Cool. How are we doing on time?
1 minute.
Yeah, I don't know, Zach. Do you have any sort of like questions or things that you would like more fleshed out?
I want to know. I just feel like Free Willy is a good model for like the relationship between a boy and a creature from nature.
Yep.
So I guess I'm just wondering like what are some of the like memorable moments between this lady and her lion?
I mean, I think that like her standing up to her father or the ringmaster or whoever it is that wants to kind of get rid of
the
cub that is
cub
not
that's
performing.
Around.
Yeah. I think that's a big one. Mm-hmm.
The sequence of rearing.
Yes.
The cub.
Right. Yeah. Their first like ride in a car together.
Aww, that's cute.
Yeah. And then you know, you have the first where like
the first mauling. No.
No, but like of four. But like the first like actual like putting the dome together and like you know, the first ride in front of a crowd. And yeah, you could have like an accidental mauling or a mauling that's been set up by a rival or something like that.
And I think there also needs to be the moment where she kind of gets like accidentally, you know, hit by something or elbowed in the wrong moment or something. And she falls into the lion pen with all the like sort of big, actually, you know, dangerous lions.
Right.
But then her lion sort of like jumps in and sort of manages to
like,
you know, back them off. And that's the first moment that like the runt beats the full grown animals, which is a sentence that's just going to keep on going. So that as long as I don't run out of breath, the time is not over, Zach. You can't tell me that it's over.
I don't think that changes how time works, but that was a good thread. And wow, I am delighted and appalled with where this story
well,
is.
Well, same.
Yeah,
same.
Yes.
Hats off, Zach. This was such a high concentration of bad idea.
Oh my gosh.
On just like, you know, like safety to people. No. Good treatment of animals. No. Sustainability in any way. No. People learning from their mistakes. No.
I've never been Spectator so certain safety. About the badness no. of an idea that I brought in. So thank you for running with that terrible, terrible
oh
idea.
Oh my God. No, this was awful.
Thank you all at home for listening. We'll be right back.
All right. After that insanity, we are back here to talk with Lindsay Amer of Queer Kid Stuff and other cool online things.
Yeah, other online things. All the things.
And TED Talks.
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
So I'm curious, how do you, because working in children's media, I imagine mm-hmm. that there's a little bit of a difference in approaching storytelling, but maybe more similarities than I've thought of. I'm curious how you think of storytelling, what you've learned in the process of creating Queer Kid Stuff and maybe some of the other projects you're developing.
Yeah, totally. There isn't that much that's different about children's storytelling. I think that the biggest thing for me is, one, you have to have like a young protagonist. That's just mm-hmm. like a practical thing that you kind of need for mm-hmm. most children's story. There are children's stories without that, but it's usually better if you have like some sort of child's voice in there. And structure is pretty much the same, if not more formulaic, because kids need to be able to latch on something familiar.
Right.
You can't really like experiment as much with structure in children's media just because structure is how children understand new things. So needing kind of like a skeleton that's familiar to be able to process everything else that's going on. It's why I find comfort in structure. Mm-hmm. And it's a big reason why I love children's storytelling and why I love like watching Pixar movies. Like I know how that story is going to make me feel as we go through it. So I understand the like emotional journey of the experience of a child's story. But there's still a lot that like my brain can play with without having to be kind of distracted by the format. And then I think the biggest thing for me is just like simplifying. Mm-hmm. It's not about like dumbing anything down, and it's not about like not having an interesting, nuanced, complex story. Like look at something like Inside Out, and that is super complex. If you're just like looking at like how that story works and like the world that it builds, like it's a pretty complex, like fully realized world that you're stepping into. But what you're getting at is just like the core of the idea is what you have to show. So like with that story in particular, you're really just focusing on these characters and the fact that they have something that is like so relatable to what any person can relate to. And so it's about finding like a universality. So why like something like Coco works when you're in, you know, Mexico. And you're, you know, dealing in like a little bit of a language that not everybody mm-hmm. can understand and a culture that's not that people don't always have like a first person experience with. But that's still an incredibly relatable story because you're talking about music, which is a mm-hmm. universal idea. And you're talking about like feeling stifled by your parents, which is definitely a universal idea for kids. So it's about I think like the elements are like, what is that universality? And then what is like the texture and culture you want to put around it? So those are kind of like, So like having
those are the steps,
having like a structure, having something simple and universal and having this like beautiful, like thing that you want to like put around and like wrap that in as like your gift wrap.
Right. I love that. I think about that a lot of. Achieving simplicity in expression, mm-hmm. but not simplicity in idea,
exactly.
which I think is something that a lot of people mm-hmm. conflate, where, you know, there is sort of this idea of if this is going to be a simple story, then it cannot deal with a huge, big, complicated topic.
Exactly. And I'm also talking about like really good children's storytelling.
Oh, sure.
There's a lot of really, really terrible children's storytelling out there that is rough, real rough.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of kind of the mediocre fast food equivalent of children's stories out there. In the same way that unfortunately, a lot of kids end up eating a lot of fast food, they also end up hearing a lot of kind of really terrible schlock as they kind of grow up.
Like Peppa Pig videos on YouTube.
Oh, boy.
What a dark corner.
Very dark corner.
Is there something that you're writing now that you're sort of exploring some of these things with?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of in the middle of moving into more narrative work, which kind of comes through my background. My background isn't actually in education. It's in theater and performance studies, so like storytelling and live storytelling in particular. And I've just kind of moved into digital media because that's
where it is.
That's where it's all at right now. So I've got like a couple projects. I've been working on a picture book, which, man, writing picture books is real freaking hard.
Really?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's the closest thing I can think of is that it's like writing poetry.
That makes all the sense. The brevity
of it, and like the needing to have a full, fleshed out, and interesting story in that amount of space.
Yeah, it's poetry plus narrative, but like, oh boy,
the economy is, I think, unforgiving.
Yeah, and then also like, I'm not an illustrator, so I don't have the like visual, because like that's most of the story too, and I don't have the brain to be able to think that part of the story through. So like just needing to trust that someone be able to do that is picture book writing is hard.
I hear that's also typically how it's done, though. It's like written by, like, obviously there's like the super duper heroes that just do it all, but I've heard that there's like, you know, you write it and then somebody else
What I've heard, I haven't gone through this process yet, and hopefully I will, but they keep the illustrator and the author super separated, which is it's a practice in the industry, and it's very interesting. I don't know. I'm sure that there have been like horror stories.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I think industry-wide, that's like kind of the thing that they do. But yeah, so that's one project that I'm working on. I'm also working on potentially a narrative spinoff of Queer Kid Stuff.
Oh, cool.
So a series that would explore Lindsay and Teddy's relationship and kind of like the journey of creating Queer Kid Stuff. And like, I came out as non-binary while I did the show, and Teddy has kind of like developed as a character a little bit, and just kind of trying to figure out like what does figuring out life as queer people in the Trump era look like on the other side of the screen. So I'm trying to kind of figure that out as like a way for the series to kind of continue living on. And I think that you can still explore interesting ideas that like were alive in the series through a narrative view like that, and maybe get even more nuanced with it, which would be exciting.
And what form would the narrative take? Would it sort of be kind of still in video? Would it be in...
or as a sort of a series of episodes, or as a film, or...
Yeah, I'm imagining it more as... interesting podcast. I'm imagining it more as like a limited web series.
Oh, cool.
Just to kind of like track like maybe like the first year of like Trump, and like pinpointing like different cultural things that happened throughout that. So like the election, the like Muslim ban, the trans
military
thing, like, and like the women's march, like, so like tracking maybe like that first year, and then also tracking the first year of the web series. And those kind of two things being parallel, and Lindsay and Teddy kind of becoming public figures, Lindsay coming out as non-binary. I met my partner while I was doing the like first like couple years of the web series. So like putting a love story in there. And I'm thinking about having Lindsay be, I keep talking about like Lindsay, this character, and it's like, it's me, but it's also a persona. Thinking about putting that character as a preschool teacher. So kind of figuring out how to be in a space with children. And I was working at a preschool when I was first starting Queer Kid Stuff. So that kind of feeding into it as well. So it's taking a lot of elements of like my life and my experience creating Queer Kid Stuff and just putting it through a little bit of like a prism to refract it a little bit and make it a more interesting story than just my life on paper.
And I'd love to just hear a little bit more about what happens in that prism. Sort of what do you think is getting elongated or exaggerated or sort of, you know, kind of what are, and this may be sort of something that happens entirely unconsciously. Mm-hmm. A lot of doing this show has kind of taught me how unconscious a lot of kind of the storytelling decisions that we often make kind of are. But I'm always sort of curious on things like this that draw a lot on people's own life. Mm-hmm. What are sort of like the guidelines that you're using when it comes to dramatizing and abstracting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the biggest thing for me is like putting the timeline on it, mm-hmm. First of all, and like pulling like a storytelling structure on it. Like, what is like the structure that I would want for like one season of this, like maybe like 10 episode web series?
Yeah.
And figuring out like, okay, how do I take these moments from my life and make them, where do I put them in that structure? And then how do I make them all happen at the same time? And how do I make them interesting and entertaining? And I mean, obviously Teddy is not a living, breathing stuffed animal.
You're breaking my heart right now. Listeners, if you have not met Teddy yet, you have to meet Teddy.
Teddy's great. But yeah, so they would be essentially like puppeted in the web series. I thought for a little bit about like if I wanted to make it more mainstream, I would like turn it into a kid. But I think that it's more like,
I think you could still probably have it be a living puppet. Oh, TV's gotten weird.
Yeah, and I think that like that weirdness of it makes it more interesting.
Yeah,
and
totally.
People freaking love Teddy, and I have no idea why. people care way more about Teddy than they care about me. Whenever I go to a live event, everyone's like, "Where's Teddy?" And I'm like, "Teddy's scared of the subway sometimes." but I try to bring Teddy around. I just get nervous.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a backup of Teddy, because Teddy is my like real childhood stuffed teddy bear.
Oh Lord.
So it's a thing, but figuring it out. But yeah, so I think for the web series, yeah, it's just like picking and choosing things and figuring out like what stuff I want to put like on the Lindsay character and what stuff I want to put on the Teddy character. Mm-hmm. So I like in the beginning of the web series and like Trump stuff, I was definitely going through like a quarter life crisis and figuring that out. And so I don't think that's interesting on Lindsay. I think it's more interesting on Teddy.
Huh.
To give Teddy like a quarter life crisis. So I think that it's about, I don't want to just retell my life. I want to tell a story about making this thing that's contemporary and interesting for families, because there are so many families who are like dealing with this time that we're living in and trying to raise kids.
Oh yeah.
And it's I think that that's like a big thing of like why people watch queer kid stuff, especially queer families, of like, how do I talk about these things with my kid? Like when there were like all like school shootings, like how do you address like safety at schools with kids? And I was like trying to like, you know, queer kid stuff is this very like positive space and trying to keep that sacred,
right,
but also acknowledging like what's happening in the world around us. There's Zach is wearing a Mr. Rogers shirt right now, and I get a lot of inspiration from him. But there's this one thing, and they talk about this in the documentary about him. But there was, when Mr. Rogers was filming, and I think the earlier years, it was during Jim Crow era laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the police officer, Mr. McFeely, or the mailman. I always forget if it's the police officer or the mailman, was a black man, Francois Clemens. And there's one episode where Mr. Rogers is giving himself a foot bath in the lawn, and he invites Mr. McFeely over to take a foot bath with him. And this was during the Jim Crow era law that public pools were segregated. Mm. So he was doing that like really cool, nuanced, radical thing in a children's show in a way that was, and combating that idea in a way that was appropriate for his audience.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like the ethos I take from his work, and trying to figure out how to like, you know, address the Muslim ban in a way that makes sense for my audience. And the way I did that was like bringing on a queer Muslim person and talking about like what it means to be a queer Muslim person and like what is a hijab, and having Teddy ask that question. So I think that's kind of like what this like narrative version of it is trying to look at, of like, how do we deal with these things in our lives?
Yeah.
I'm also, I have a lot of things going on.
That's admirable.
I'm trying. I'm also working on, I'm like, sort of halfway through, but also I need to rework the whole thing, which I think is probably pretty normal of a screenplay that I'm trying to figure out.
That's indeed super normal.
Yeah, I took a 101 class last summer and then wrote 40 pages and then got stuck and then took another screenwriting class and I was like, oh, I need to change the entire structure. But yeah, so that is, it's kind of like a queer Disney movie.
Oh, cool.
It's got like a non-binary protagonist set in the 1920s, 1930s. Uh-huh. And it follows this protagonist who is a young Jewish immigrant, like tomboy, non-binary character.
Not a motorcycle racer.
Not a motorcycle racer.
I was going to ask, when do they meet the lion?
No lions. So they kind of travel to America with their mother and sisters. And the mother and a couple of the sisters die in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And then we jump a bunch of years and they end up needing to cross-dress to join the construction crew of the Empire State Building.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so cool.
It's cool. It's a really cool story. And it would be a musical and there would be like a queer love story.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's like a pretty epic piece, which means it is a doozy to write.
Right, I can only imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is like a big project that I've been like slowly hacking away at, and I'm a lot happier with my structure now. It still needs some tweaks. I like actually need to give every single supporting character a drive and a goal and a dream, and mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, everything needs to be, you know, a two-dimensional human, and that's hard. I can imagine doing a wolf was you had a lot of characters you were dealing with.
But weirdly, because it was such a closed-off space mm-hmm. and it kind of took place on board a space station, mm-hmm. there was a real tight control about sure. when new characters showed up.
Sure.
So it was kind of easy
It was easy to prep.
That's
and nice. It was very easy to kind of be like, we know everything about everyone because it's just 12 people.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, it's going to be like a... It's got to be... probably at this point like a 20 person ensemble, something like that. It's nuts, and it's the first time I've ever written any like long form thing like this, because I'm used to writing like 5 minute episodes. right
That's so a huge jump.
Yeah, so it's a really big jump, but it's a story that I'm like, I really am passionate about, and I was sitting on it for like 3 years and like trying, I like had the idea around the Empire State Building and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory and couldn't quite figure out the way in, and then finally did, and
that's great,
hacking away at it.
That's awesome. I'm one of the things that I'm hearing in this that is heartening is the sort of normalcy of multi-year development, mm-hmm. which as a ADD individual, I feel like I naturally came into the game very impatient, thinking that it, like, what's wrong with me? Like, why, you know, why isn't mm-hmm. this done already?
Oh, yeah. I'm playing a long game. I think at least with the screenplay, like, it's not going to be finished or in any, like, form that I can, like, show it to people for another, like, probably year or two, more likely two. And then once that script is ready, I mean, I'll shop it around and get it in front of people. But, like, no studio is going to make that for children for another, like, couple years. And then after that, it's going to be, like, 3 to 5 years to actually make it, because it's probably going to be animated.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that like by the time that whole timeline is done, then the world will be ready for a queer protagonist in a Disney movie. So that's kind of like the timeline that my brain is working on of like, okay, I need to be working on this now so that this is ready to go out into the world in a decade.
Wow.
It's a little nutty, but like that's kind of like what you got to deal with.
That's how Avatar happened.
Yeah.
Not The Last Airbender. The blue people one.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I was thinking about The Last Airbender.
I'm sure that it also took a long time. Well,
and I think that there's also kind of an element of, you know, scripts for Disney movies that look this way don't start showing up. Mm-hmm. It's going to take even longer for the world to get ready.
Exactly. And like you're also
dealing... And we're past due already.
Agreed. And I mean... It's less about like the creation of the thing itself, and I'm also timing it out with a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And like that takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's just starting, but like that means it's gonna be
another
like,
decade.
Yeah, exactly. Because like how long did marriage equality take? You know?
too long.
Very too long. And like that also like happened in like the blink of an eye when it finally did happen, at least in America. It's still happening all over the world. And that's, and I mean, that's the big reason why Disney doesn't do queer things. And I mean, generally, there isn't any movie with that because of international distributors.
Right.
Because that's where Disney makes all of its money.
It is where they make all of their money.
It's where they make all of their money. So you got to, it's not just a shift in the United States, it's a worldwide shift.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that shift has like mostly happened in about 10 years.
We're right there with you.
At least so, that it can like push the scale. That's like, I'm waiting to be like the last like thing that drops.
Yeah, like the grain of rice in Mulan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go.
You got it.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, where can people find you if they want to explore more of your work and maybe even, you know, just where is Lindsay's internet palace?
Yeah. I like that. you can find Queer Kid Stuff on YouTube. Just search Queer Kid Stuff, or I have a website called queerkidstuff.com where that all lives as well. You can find me and Queer Kid Stuff on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook if you want to. Just the handles are at Queer Kid Stuff, and my handle is at Linz Amer, LINDZAMER. Those are the places, and I have a website, lindzamer.com. Yeah, that too.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to have you.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Wow, it was great fun to have you
pleasure,
here.
Pleasure, yeah.
And thank you all for listening. Until next time.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at patreon.com/nobadideas. And if you love the show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks. See you next week.